Hey, everybody. Welcome to this week's Kingdom Culture podcast hosted by the Christian Family and Children's Center. I'm your host today, Dr. D. Merle Skinner. I am so excited. As you guys know, we talk about 1,000 things on this podcast, everything from family to counseling to education to cultural issues to all kinds of things. And today I have actually a former student and a friend, Peter Weeks, who's the district attorney at Blair County with us. And I'm just so excited because of the work that he does, because of his life, because of his value system, about us getting a little bit of an inside look in what it's like to be a DA. Like that's, Pete, this is just really good to have you here today. Tell everybody a little bit about yourself and what you do.
Well, first of all, thanks for having me. I really appreciate the opportunity. It was great. Getting a tour of the North Campus because this did not exist when I was a student. So it's it's amazing here, and I just can't believe all the work that you guys have done. I have been fortunate enough to serve as a prosecutor in Blair County since 2007. And Blair County, if you don't know, is the Altoona area, so it's a little bit south of State College or Penn State University. Altoona is the largest city and where we have most of our prosecutorial opportunities because of the, unfortunately, the type of crime that occurs in Altoona. So I started in 2007 as a dedicated drug and drug-related violence prosecutor. And in 2018, I had the opportunity to become first assistant in the office. 2020, I had the opportunity to become district attorney in the office. And so I still get to prosecute cases, which is what I enjoy doing. But now there's more administrative and supervisory, you know, duties that go along with that.
Man, what a tough job. I think about, particularly in our audience, I don't know who's listening today, Pete, but, you know, many of us sit back in our armchair. I always laugh at the armchair quarterbacks, particularly Christians, who sit back and say, well, if I was just in charge, you know, I'd be doing this. And So Pete, I am sure that I want to talk a little bit about what got you here. But one of the things I'd like to talk about today is a little bit about what's it like to sit in that chair. It's different. You know, everybody can talk about what it's like to be in that chair, but to actually make decisions and to affect lives significantly, whether those are criminals or whether those are people that we're not sure if they're guilty or not, or whether it's families of people, that's got to be a very, very difficult job. I'm curious, what brought you to be like, hey, I want to be a prosecutor? Like, you know, how did you get there?
Well, I went to undergrad at Penn State. Mm-hmm. And when I started out, I wasn't quite sure what I wanted to do. And one of the things that I thought I might want to do is pursue a career in the FBI or something, you know, like that. Mm-hmm. It sounded exciting or interesting to me. While I was at Penn State, I had a number of vehicle break-ins where people were breaking into my vehicle, other people's vehicle, damaging it, stealing property. And I was very dissatisfied with how the district attorney's office and the police handled those situations. Uh-huh. And in fact, I was dissatisfied enough to where I thought to myself, there's a better way to do this. And I would like to be involved in that process. Now, I certainly haven't had a career prosecuting vehicle theft cases, but those type of cases kind of hit home for me the most, because I want to say that our criminal justice system tends to overlook cases like that. Someone steals something from your vehicle, or they steal your vehicle, or they break mm-hmm. in your home. And sometimes, many times, the criminal justice system overlooks the victim or overlooks the impact of crimes that are minor in terms of they're not a homicide, you know, they're not a stabbing, they're not a sexual assault, but still have a significant impact on the victim or society. So I was dissatisfied with my experience, decided that was something I wanted to pursue. And when I started law school, that was my objective. Mm-hmm. When I told my guidance counselor at law school that that's what I wanted to do, her response was, "Are your grades bad?" And I said, "No, this is the career that I want to choose." And she looked at me like I came from Mars. But
really,
that, and I will say that when you start as a prosecutor, at least back then, so I clerked for about a year and a half, 2 years, and started as a prosecutor in 2007. And I started off in the low $30,000 range. So mm-hmm. when you have law school debt,
right, makes it very difficult.
And if you are making, you know, six figures at a private firm, mm-hmm. You can see where that question comes in. But mm-hmm. I believe then, and I believe more than ever now, that if you want to have impact as a professional, especially as a lawyer, on your society, being a prosecutor is the best way to do that.
That's pretty amazing. Well, and let me just add, sorry to interrupt you there, but just to add, thinking about you as a kid growing up, as I knew your life, justice was always important to you, right? I mean, it felt to me like that you are not only that, but actually purpose. Like, you know, I'm very intentional about your life. And that is a cool thing. So I want to say to all of you families out there and all the kids that might be listening, don't give up. Don't let reality, quote unquote reality, take away your purpose. Because it's, Pete, it sounds like that this is your purpose, right?
I certainly believe so. And I believe that, you know, God put opportunities in front of me and I was fortunate enough to, you know, have those opportunities and benefit from them. But yeah, I've always kind of been purpose driven. Mm-hmm. But I'll also say too that, you know, growing up very often, I was kind of laughing to myself when you gave me a tour of your office and I was sitting down. I was like, well, I'm not in trouble and I'm not getting, you know, another talk about me being inappropriate. I had the experience of my, you know, when I was in elementary school at the other campus, my mother was my teacher for many of those grade levels. And as, you know, many children, or at least I sometimes had a problem with my temper or a problem with what I would say. So I would visit you often, probably on a daily basis.
I don't think it was quite that much, Pete. It might have felt like that, but.
But, you know, learning at an early age or being forced to learn, you know, being held accountable mm-hmm. for developing patience, developing restraint, things like that. To go back to your, you know, initial question, I think as to be a successful prosecutor and to do the business that I do, you know, when sometimes you're dealing with a case where you're offering someone a life sentence, mm-hmm. It requires humility and it requires restraint. It requires you to look at everything without an ego and to look at things with an open mind. To go to your second question is, you know, what if you, you know, you're prosecuting someone and you don't know if they're guilty or if you don't know if they're innocent? I tell everyone when I do presentations that, in my opinion, being a prosecutor is one of the best jobs in the whole world because our job is different from that of any other lawyer. Most mm-hmm. lawyers have the task of representing their client within the rules of ethics. We do not have that task. We have the task of, as a prosecutor, seeking justice. Mm-hmm. So that means at the 11 and a half hour or in the middle of a trial, if evidence comes to light that changes the dynamic. Let's say, okay, I know this person didn't commit the crime, or I know they were less involved than than the evidence suggested in the beginning. Then not only my ability, but my duty, my job mm-hmm. is to then change my approach to that case, whether it's withdrawing the case or saying, okay, I made you this offer based on my understanding that you were this involved. Now I understand that you were less or more involved. So my duty is to change and act accordingly with the evidence.
True justice, right? I mean, really.
And that's how it's supposed to work. Yes, yeah. And right. It's not too many jobs have that opportunity.
And I keep thinking about no matter what side of the seat I would be on, I would love to have a DA like you over that. No matter if I was falsely accused of something, but let's assume that I'm not going to intentionally do something, that I'm falsely accused of something, or if I'm a victim of somebody or a part of a family's victim. You want somebody like that. I mean, that was the biblical model, right? That was what God taught Aaron and Moses and, you know, and the judges, you know, King Solomon, you know, the whole nine yards was to really use discernment and stuff. So our prayer might be that we'd have more of you, Pete, out there, that that we'd see more people called to do that, because you're right. It is such a calling and a cool thing. I think that's so cool, Pete. That's really a cool thing. So I know maybe that probably doesn't feel cool many times, but it really is.
It being a prosecutor is definitely not a popularity contest, and you definitely don't make a lot of friends if you do your job the right way, because you're always, a lot of times, offending both sides mm-hmm. because one side doesn't think you're acting fast enough mm-hmm. or hard enough, and the other side, you know, thinks you shouldn't be taking that action at all. So Many times I found that if you're truly trying to do the right thing, you're going to make a lot of people upset.
Right. So for our audience out there, again, one of our things is to get a feel for this. And so I would love to have you pray for Pete, but also for your, have you thought about praying for your local DA, you know, somebody who is, I would assume it's a thankless job for the most point, unless you arrest the mob boss or something like that. It's probably not, you probably don't get too many people coming to your house saying, thank you, Pete, for the work that you do. But that would be a great thing for us to do, is to pray for that justice, for that, for the discernment for our DAs, and for the whole, really for the whole legal system. But Pete, as we kind of turn this a little bit to, hey, what's it feel like to be in those shoes? You've already talked about it. It's probably a very lonely position, I'm assuming, right?
In terms of how you go about your day-to-day life, I would say, yeah, I typically don't socialize out in the community a ton, just because of the dynamic, you know.
Right.
If you're in a social system, you might be encountering someone you're prosecuting. You might,
right,
you know, have that question, answer, feedback back and forth. So it's a little different that way. But it also gives you the ability to interact with, you know, the community professionally, interact mm-hmm. with law enforcement.
Right.
So, I mean, there are a lot of opportunities to interact with people. So I think it's kind of a mixed bag in that.
Like most high level positions, I mean, it really is. There's a cost to it. But what about what would you say to our folks that are armchair quarterback and say, hey, let's just get tough on crime. Let's just do this. Let's do that. What are the nuances that make your job difficult, Pete? In terms of just, because again, you are a justice kind of a guy. I mean, know you well enough to know that if there's somebody that's really done something wrong, you want to see justice for them. But what makes your job difficult that way?
Well, I think you have to have two approaches to that. One is, you first of all, before anything else, you need to make sure you have sufficient evidence to file charges and to prosecute someone. So sometimes you have that sufficient evidence right away.
Mm-hmm.
And there, I think it would be unjust to delay.
Mm-hmm.
For example, you know, if you have a case where there, you know, we've had violent sexual assaults that are immediately reported by the victim, you know, and my approach as a prosecutor is, you know, we charge that right away.
Mm-hmm.
If we, you know, believe the evidence supports charging, because we want to remove that person from society and start the criminal process. There are some times where we think something's going on, but it takes years to investigate.
Mm-hmm.
I've been involved in two different homicide prosecutions that took over 3 years apiece.
Wow.
To file charges, because that's how long the evidence gathering process to get sufficient evidence to move forward. Some homicides that I've been involved with, we charge the night of the homicide.
Yeah.
So I think having the evidence is extremely important. And then once you have the evidence, it becomes, I think, determining what justice is.
Mm.
And justice isn't certainly what we see in Philadelphia and San Francisco and places
right.
like that, where it's a, you know, get out of jail free, behave how you want to behave, there are no consequences.
Mm-hmm.
Justice also isn't, you know, a medieval approach where, you know, the first time you shoplift, we cut your hand off
right.
and don't allow any opportunity for rehabilitation.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there needs to be a sliding scale with that. You can do that different ways. I've always been a big fan, going back to the drug, you know, example,
mm-hmm.
if you prosecute someone very young who is trafficking in drugs or using drugs, you know, I try to use, you know, when it's permitted under the guidelines, you know, some type of rehabilitative approach through probation or something that doesn't involve incarceration.
Mm-hmm.
Come back and do it again, then we're talking about incarceration.
Mm-hmm.
Come back and do it a third time, we're talking about a lot of incarceration.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, a little bit of a sliding scale to see, okay, how can we use different resources depending on, is this your first violation? Is it your third violation? The other thing you have to look at is certainly is the gravity or the seriousness of the offense. If you go out and kill somebody,
right.
that's kind of out the window, because
right.
it's the impact of your crime is so significant. But
yeah.
if you're talking about, you know, as I said before, you know, if it's, you know, shoplifting or a first drug offense, then I think more resources should be put into seeing if we can give you the tools that you need as the offender to rehabilitate, because if that happens, everybody wins.
Right. So Pete, can I ask, because I think, again, I think about this and I think about the parallel of the Christian faith, you know, with God, you know what I mean? God's like, if God cut my hand off, you know what, I deserved it every time. I mean, I would have no hands, I'd have no feet, I'd have nothing, but because he is gracious, he's a gracious God, but he is. So that really is a cool thing. Can you talk about rehabilitation a little bit, or just do you have any just insights? I know that there's some statistics out there and that kind of stuff. I'm not looking for that. Just from your practice, do people sometimes, or do you see people like a lot of times, hey, I'm not doing this again. This is enough. This is a wake up call. Do you have any keys or insights into that from your experience that would be helpful? Because I think that's what we'd hope, right? We'd hope that the system serves to say, wait a second, you're on a bad path. You've got to change this. You got to repent, like the scripture talks about.
Certainly. And I've seen rehabilitation occur with people who are first offenders or people who were, you know, serial offenders for, you know, over a decade. The first and foremost, the person has to want to be rehabilitated, and they have to put the effort in. Mm-hmm. So certainly part of the key is having the resources and the opportunity available to people. That opportunity looks different for different types of offenders. Some people get that opportunity, you know, after being released from prison and while they're on parole. And some people get that opportunity in a diversion program that they don't have to spend any time in prison. Mm-hmm. But you're only going to see rehabilitation when the individual decides that they want to take accountability for their actions and they want to become a different person. And then the second key, I think, is no matter what type of situation that person's in, there has to be in the criminal justice system, if you're looking to foster rehabilitation, there has to be accountability. Mm-hmm. Where I see systems in disarray right now in the county I work in Blair County, our juvenile justice system is out of control. Mm. It is highly unsuccessful and is not rehabilitating young people. And the reason, first and foremost, I believe, is that there's no accountability in the system. So people
enter the system, but there's no way to assess how well they're doing, and no feedback loops to let the person know you're on the right track, you're not on the right track. Is that what you mean?
Well, that's part of it. Yes. Yeah. So there isn't, if you're not doing, for example, if it's a juvenile situation, in my opinion, you should have, you know, regular drug tests. You should be checking social media.
Right.
You should be enforcing a curfew. You should be talking with parents and trying to get them involved.
Mm-hmm.
If there are no parents to get involved or they're not doing an adequate job at that point, then you get, you know, children, youth, and families involved, you know, a social service agency if that's necessary. But accountability is also consequence.
Mm.
So if there are no, for example, if you have someone, whether an adult or a juvenile, and their issue is drugs, and they fail drug tests, and there are no consequences, then there's no impetus for them to change their behavior.
Yeah.
They're going to just keep violating because they're being taught or trained that there is no con. It's very much like having children.
Yeah.
And that's not to say that adult offenders are like children in every aspect, but if you have kids or, you know, you've raised children or are raising children, if there's no consequence for certain types of behavior, that you're a fool if you think that behavior won't continue.
Absolutely.
And in fact, it'll get worse.
You're reinforcing it.
Right.
And intermittent reinforcement is even harder, you know.
Right.
to change.
So. And so when you have an offender and you are hoping that they rehabilitate, but there is no consequence, you're never going to see that rehabilitation. So Blair County has had for over 25 years, a drug court program. Unfortunately, right now, that drug court program hasn't accepted any new applicants since November of 2024, and that's really hurt, or 2023, and that's really hurt us. But one of the keys to running that program successfully is providing consequence.
Mm-hmm.
And we saw in COVID, when we took away our sanctions because of all the concerns about incarceration or putting people in jail, how populated is the jail, all of those concerns.
Oh my.
We switched incarceration as a sanction to unmonitored house arrest. And our the success went down the toilet.
Yeah.
Because there wasn't consequence and accountability in the program designed to rehabilitate people.
It's true for all of us, not just if I can eat M&Ms all day and never gain a pound, I'm going to probably keep eating M&Ms all day, you know. But so it is very, very. So that's really interesting, Pete. I'm going to switch gears just a little bit. There's so much we could talk about. I know we're going to run out of time, but and unfortunately, you're too far away for us to do a second podcast right away. So we'll have to talk about that down the road. But what? How does your faith play into this, Pete? And in terms of the role that you do, if you're comfortable talking about that, just because it, in my mind, the awesome responsibility over people's lives that you have, people can either dismiss that and say, I'm king, I get to do whatever I want to do, dismiss the reality of it, or take it very seriously. So, I mean, I'm sure there's probably other options, but how does God and your service to God and your thoughts about God fit into this whole thing?
Well, I think that happens in kind of two different ways. One is that humility factor and understanding that the only true judge out there mm-hmm. is God. Mm-hmm. And he does that eternally.
Yeah.
Now, do we have to enforce rules here on earth and mm-hmm. do women and men have to do that? Mm-hmm. Yes, mm-hmm. certainly. In order to have a functional, ordered society, where, you know, people behave and respect each other. Unfortunately, we need rules and we need enforcement of that rules because those rules because of sin and because of the state of the world in general. But understanding first and foremost that ultimately punishment, the true punishment, is up to God, mm-hmm. and taking a humble approach to that, I think, is certainly important. Mm. And then acting out of your responsibility and your not out of, you know, being vindictive, mm-hmm. or you know, being too lenient, but just, you know, enforcing the rules, no matter who the person is, mm-hmm. you know, whether it's someone you want to go easy on or someone, you know, maybe who people don't like, mm-hmm. yeah, throw that stuff out of the window and you assess it on what kind of evidence do you have and, you know, how serious is the offense and where does that person fit on in terms of, are they a new offender, a repeat offender, things like that. And then secondarily, I think always being aware that, you know, as a prosecutor, a lot of times I negotiate a sentence, but a lot of times the judge sets a sentence that I don't control it. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I think it should be more. Sometimes I think it should be less. But understanding that at the end of the day, what happens with a person is not just up to me, but up to the justice system as a whole. And, you know, hey, if you have to understand, if that person reforms, everybody wins. You know, mm-hmm. if someone doesn't get the sentence I asked for and I think they should have gone to jail and they get probation, but they stay out of trouble, you know, that's accept that and move on. And that's a win for everybody. And, you know, it's okay to be wrong about that. I will say it's easier to be wrong that way. Everyone likes being wrong that way. I've had some domestic violence cases where the victim wasn't cooperative, and to get them to cooperate, I promised probation mm-hmm. when the guidelines or the suggested sentence was several years in jail. Mm-hmm. And at the victim's request, we gave probation, and that person, you know, a couple of times that I can think of off the top of my head, turned around and either hurt that victim again or mm-hmm. hurt a common child that they and the victim had. And that's tough to live with when you get it wrong the other way.
I
think as a Christian, you have to understand that God is in control. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as a human, we're not, you know, we control very little.
Mm-hmm. Well, Pete, it'd be amazing if every DA approach this like that. I mean, and I'm sure they don't. I'm sure there's great DAs and things like that. But what a fortunate county that you serve. So let's turn this to the topic of the day, which is the drug culture, right? Which maybe you can explain a little bit about how that happens. We've got about 10 minutes left to do this. Talk a little bit about why you end up in dealing with the drug culture so much, and maybe try to address a little bit about what you think people should know about this or what's interesting. I'll probably pop in there with a couple questions, but
sure. So obviously there's two types of drug offenses, and you have drug offenses with people who use and are addicted to drugs mm-hmm. and then people who sell or traffic those mm-hmm. drugs to the users. And there is a big intersection there, because most people, if they become addicted to drugs such as heroin, fentanyl, methamphetamine, crack cocaine, what we would call like the harder drugs, mm-hmm. they're going to end up selling drugs to obtain their own drugs. So they're going to be intersecting at both of those spots. Mm-hmm. But we see, at least in Blair County, the vast majority of all of our crime is drug related. Mm-hmm. And that's because drug users steal things to get drugs. They steal money. They steal property. Mm-hmm. They behave, you know, sometimes violently, or they hurt people when they're on drugs. So there are a lot of negative impacts from drug use. Mm-hmm. And those who traffic in drugs, you can't hire, you know, Acme Security or State Farm to ensure and enforce, you know, your drug business and yeah. collect your drug debts. That's done through, you know, violence and intimidation. Mm-hmm. So most of our homicides are drug related. Most of our, many of our, you know, serious assault cases. A lot of our, what fits the definition of Pennsylvania sex trafficking mm-hmm. are people who utilize controlled substances to obtain, you know, sex from people who are addicted to drugs, or frankly, they force them to become addicted to drugs. So you see a lot of negative impact on society from drug use and drug trafficking. Mm-hmm. I think where it hits home is, unfortunately, almost all of us now know someone who struggles with drug addiction. Right. And that's for a couple different reasons. Marijuana is becoming more and more popular, more and more mainstream. Mm-hmm. It is, you know, more acceptable to use marijuana, which certainly not everyone who uses marijuana goes on to use fentanyl and heroin and methamphetamine. But almost every single person that I've encountered who's addicted to methamphetamine, heroin, fentanyl started with marijuana.
Pete, let me just interject there, because I do think that our, and that's going on in Pennsylvania, of course, this big conversation. It seems like the only people that don't understand marijuana as a gateway drug are the marijuana suppliers. And I bet they understand it as well, too. Yeah. But that is really a hard, that's a hard thing for me. And we even talk about alcohol in that sense, too, as well. But do you have any thoughts about that whole piece of the puzzle at all, Pete? I'm sure you probably do, but that strikes me as a real important part of the conversation, because it's public policy, right?
Yeah, it certainly is. And unfortunately, I think the economic benefit of marijuana, or the perceived economic benefit of marijuana, has blinded a lot of people mm-hmm. to the negatives. But if you look at some of the studies that have come out from places like Colorado who have both recreational and medical marijuana, mm-hmm. you'll see that the cost on the government actually outweighs, in many instances, the benefit to the government mm-hmm. Through the marijuana tax, because the ER visits are up. You have mental health issues spiking. You have destruction of property, you know, or just litter,
right?
You know, associated with public marijuana use. So there are a lot of drawbacks to that. But, you know, so certainly I have very strong opinions on whether that's good or bad for society. I think that it's leading us down a path that in 10 years, we're going to say, why did we do this? What, you know, why did we push for that? And there's going to have to be a reckoning.
Right. As a mental health professional, I feel the same way, Pete. And I, you know, and again, there are some bunny trails we could go down about that frame that conversation, but I would agree with you, I think. And so I don't want to get sidetracked on that, but I just think it's an important conversation, because we're actually now talking about enacting policy that is going to make your job and my job much more difficult down the road, without a doubt.
Right. And right now, as a prosecutor, the policy that the legislature has put in place it's not consistent. Mm-hmm. So even though you can obtain medical marijuana in Pennsylvania, it's not through a pharmacy. It's not approved by the FDA. It's still a Schedule I controlled substance. And if you even have a metabolite of marijuana in your system, you're still DUI. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of weird inconsistencies that the legislature has failed to rectify mm-hmm. With the changes in the law. But going back to what you asked, certainly about like the drug culture and how that touches people and what they can do about it. You know, because now it's so prevalent that almost all of us know someone or multiple people, I think it's very important. I say this a lot, but as a parent myself, and speaking to people who are parents, it is very important to provide accountability and be involved in what your kids are doing.
Absolutely.
Because if you wait until after someone has a problem, that is a losing battle.
Yeah.
Statistically, you know, if someone's addicted to heroin, when I say heroin, what I really mean is fentanyl and right. xylazine, what's killing everyone around the country, mm-hmm. or methamphetamine or crack cocaine, okay. you have somewhere between a 7 and 3% chance of recovering statistically. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean you shouldn't try it. It doesn't mean people can't do it. But that is going to be an addiction you battle for your whole life.
Right.
So to me, the key is really holding your kids accountable. We have, you know, a problem in this country with over-prescribing opioids, mm-hmm. With experimentation, you know, just a kid's junior high, high school. It's not too young to talk to your kids about drug use when they're in fifth and sixth grade.
Absolutely.
Because if you wait,
even younger now, the way we're looking and seeing, because it's actually that whole, the whole social media platforms and stuff are just pushing everything down there.
And the way I would analogize it is you want to talk to your kids about you know, abstinence before, you know, they're having sex or tempted to have sex, or do you want to wait until you have a new baby in the home and you're a grandparent in your 40s?
Now we're going to talk
about
it, right?
You know, so that's the same thing with drugs. You want to have those conversations before that's even a temptation, you know, for your children, and instill why it's bad and the value to being independent and saying no, even if everybody else is saying yes.
Right.
Because we've all been children and we know what that peer pressure is like. And there's mm-hmm. all kinds of different peer pressure. But peer pressure is generally designed to get people to conform to behavior. And a lot of times that behavior is destructive behavior.
Yeah.
But if you wait to tell your, you know, I have a 13-year-old. My 13-year-old listened a lot better when she was 10.
Yeah.
So, you know, having those conversations early, I think, is key, because now my 13-year-old at least has that foundation mm-hmm. to where from the time she was a little kid, she knows certain things are bad, certain things are immoral. You know, we don't just start when they're in eighth grade, ninth grade, because by then, unfortunately, it's probably too late. So that's a big thing.
Early intervention is really important. I know we're just rapidly running out of time here, Pete, but what else would you add about fighting the drug culture that from your perspective as a prosecutor that our listeners might really benefit from?
I think shifting from parents, if you have drug trafficking or drug use going on in your community, I would encourage people to work with law enforcement. Mm-hmm. One of the great dynamics that we have in Blair County is that although we have what I would call big city crime, like we have crime like you see in Pittsburgh, or maybe not Philadelphia, but certainly mm-hmm. Pittsburgh, you know, in Altoona. But we still have people who are willing to talk to the police.
Yeah.
You know, we had a double murder during COVID, and the people who were buying drugs from the people who were involved in the murder came forward, admitted that they were buying drugs for them because they were offended by the murder mm-hmm. and they were willing to say, like, hey, I'm a drug customer. This is what was going on. These are the names of the people involved. Mm-hmm. And if you're willing to do that, if you're willing to say, hey, my neighbor, you know, has this kind of traffic at their house or so, you know, mm-hmm. that gives the police the tools they need. And then demand accountability from your law enforcement. You want people to reform, but you also need to make the cost, especially of drug trafficking,
right.
more than the drug trafficker is willing to pay. If mm-hmm. the drug trafficker doesn't care about the penalty, then that's just going to increase. And you're right. going to have more of that behavior in your community.
And emboldens them, right?
Yes.
I mean, it really does, which it does feel like many times that we're out of control in this war, doesn't it?
And certainly.
But the truth is, it's mostly, am I correct, that it's mostly because we're not giving the justice, criminal justice system and law enforcement the tools that they need to be able to battle it. Is that true? Or
I think we have a lot of tools right now to effectively investigate it. The penalties have been watered down. Mm. From 2012 to now, mm-hmm. A case that used to be as serious as a 10-year sentence right now could be probation or a few months in jail. That's how much over the last decade and 2 years, so let's say the last decade, we've legislatively watered down drug enforcement.
Hmm.
So I think that is extremely concerning because, again, you want your community, whatever community you live in, you want the penalty for trafficking drugs to be more than the drug trafficker is willing to pay. If the drug trafficker doesn't care about the penalty, and when I say that, like a professional drug dealer doesn't care about doing 2 years in jail. Mm-hmm. If they've committed their life to trafficking in drugs, two years is nothing.
That's just training ground for them. Huh?
They will do that standing on their head, and they'll come out and they'll get right back to it. Mm-hmm. If you start giving those type of people who aren't interested in reform more significant sentences, that's when you hear, I'm not coming back to this place. I don't want anything to do with your county. And I think that's the message that you want to send to the drug traffickers. And for the drug users, you need to provide opportunities for rehabilitation, but consequences if that's not happening.
Right. So that's where a full system, and in my mind, it's a place I don't think the Christian community is engaged enough in. I know that we have programs, like we have programs here and those kinds of things as well too, but we should be more engaged as a Christian community for multiple reasons, out of concern for people who want to rehabilitate, people who want to reform, right? Obviously being a part of the bigger process is really important. Any other tips for people? Talk to the police, look for opportunities. Any other kinds of things you would say to our folks to help them help you and others like you do their job?
I think understanding that especially when you look at the media post 2020, the media has focused on the negatives with law enforcement. And unfortunately, we've had people in political office, even as high as the presidency, who have gone out of their way to highlight, the 0.5% or the 1% of law enforcement, or to frankly portray things inaccurately. Support holding law enforcement accountable is certainly important, but supporting your law enforcement, supporting the women and men who go out and serve the community, giving them the tools they need and the support they need, and understanding that the majority of them have the right intentions and are trying to serve the community and make it a better place, I think is step one, because unfortunately that mantra has been out now for at least the last four and a half years. And you've seen the negative effect that it's had in certain communities, where in San Francisco, retailers are leaving in droves because it's not safe or profitable to have a business there anymore.
I can't imagine the police department even wanting to work there.
Right.
So that obviously is a clear thing. And I think after talking today too, and hearing Pete talk, this is not an easy thing. We'd like to think that it's easy, but it's a very difficult job. But so we really do need to thank those in law enforcement and support them. Anything else you can think of, Pete, that might be helpful? I think being aware, obviously. I would add maybe one more piece while you're thinking about that, if you have anything, is that from a mental health perspective, recognizing addiction is a really complicated issue. And it when people, by the time they enter the juvenile system or the justice system at any level, there's a real problem that's been going on for a long time. So early intervention is really, really important, just like with everything. And so slapping people on the wrist and as parents and saying, hey, don't do it again. We need to really up our game for saying, wait, there's a real reason that's going on. And oftentimes self-medication is an issue is covering for something else. And so I'm encouraging people to find good help, to find good therapists, good, particularly Christian therapists that can help people work through social, emotional, spiritual, mental health problems to be able to not feel the need to escape and self-medicate. But
yeah, and that's certainly something that we see too. Early intervention and accountability are key, but recognizing when someone's in addiction, many of those people are dual diagnosis. They have mental health issues that sometimes are not properly diagnosed. Right. And they try to treat that with, hardcore drug abuse, and that is a zero-sum game. That never works out. But, recognizing that when you have someone in that addiction, that you can, support them, you can love them, but you're getting them that diagnosis and that intervention professionally is key.
Right. And I'm thinking about taking your friend, being willing to say to your friend, hey, you've got a problem. Can I go with you to a Celebrate Recovery program, to a 12-step program, or to a mental health counselor, and not just kind of laughing and looking the other way when they're falling over themselves or doing something like that? Because this is an escalating kind of an issue, without a doubt. Mental health is escalating, addictions are so. Pete, thank you. I know we're out of time. Any closing comments that you want to mention? I mean, I all I got to tell you is, why don't you move back and run for DA in our county here? So,
well, I really appreciate the opportunity to talk with you, and hopefully we'll be able to do it again.
Yeah, Pete. Let me, usually I ask our guests to pray, but if it's okay, I'd like to pray for you. And Father, I just ask your blessing upon Pete today, Lord, as he does a job that affects so many lives and is so serious. Father, that has so much responsibility. Father, that you would put people around him to lift his arms up, whether they're staff, whether they're law enforcement, whether they're fellow prosecutors, even Father, defense attorneys that would work in healthy ways to provide real justice for people. God, we pray for the DAs around the country that are oftentimes, as Pete said, unappreciated, discouraged from choosing the profession. That Father, you would call up people and anoint them to do this job and to care for them, and also put your people around them to support them. In the name of Jesus, we pray. Amen.
Amen.
Thanks for Pete for being here. As always, it's been it's great, and I got to tell you, man, I only have fond memories from our times together in the youth, in your youth. For those of you, if you want to find out more, if you have a question for Pete, you want to reach out, you can reach out to us at info@champion.org, and we'll pass it along if he can answer it. As always, you're going to be able to hear this podcast and all of our others on our webpage at champion.org/podcast. You can find out more about activities going on if you go to our website. Looking forward to our future guests, and thanks again, Pete, for being here.
Thanks for having me.